Well, I want to speak about big ideas, and I want to speak about big ideas that are big because they're universal, big because they're very deep, big because they're universal in that they impact every single person right across history. They impact all of history, but they're deep because they impact every single person, so that they impact you individually. So wherever you are, as you're sitting here tonight, they impact you and every other person. Tonight is more like an epic blockbuster than a personal drama, if I might claim that about what we're going to be doing together. Do you know the kind of two different movies you go and see? There's the movie that's the personal drama, where you got to watch sort of a problem that's happened in someone's life. I don't know, they've had a child abducted, and the movie's about seeking to resolve that terrible tension and so on, and you're watching the drama of this family and what's going on for them and so on. There's that personal drama movie. But then you've got the kind of big epic thing where, you know, it reveals a problem on a global scale. I don't know, there's a meteor that's hurtling towards Earth on a collision course, which is going to wipe out every species and a speck of life on the planet. And so the movie's actually tracking this massive impact. Or you go to an ecological movie where there's kind of unveiling of some tipping point that's about to happen in ecology, in the you know, the physics of the world, the greenhouse gases and so on. It's going to impact every person. Well, tonight is more like that. Tonight is more like the news about something that is dramatic. The scale is large. Tonight I want to draw your attention to a thing that exists on a global scale. And it's impossible to overstate the drama, the size, the scale of the things we'll be considering together tonight. It impacts every human in every country throughout every time in history since time has begun. That's the scale of it. It impacts every human, every country, every time, every point of history, which therefore means it impacts you individually. If you're here tonight, it impacts you. It impacts those who aren't with us. Now, you may feel that there's this problem. You may not, though. I suspect that many of us do. Many of us are aware that there is something wrong. With this introduction, let me just make clear that tonight is not a feel-good message. In fact, if you've not been, church ought not be about a feel-good thing. Church is not designed to be a place where you just come and feel good. You can go along and get some endorphins from a gym exercise and get that kind of activity. That's not what church is for. It rather is making a claim. What we're dealing with tonight is making a claim from God, from God's word, about humanity, about the state of humanity, about our desperate need as humans, and about what God himself, the creator, has done about it. It is massive. You know, and I'm be taking this from the scriptures. Now, every religion has its sacred texts, and every religion makes various claims about their sacred texts. I mentioned this last week, but this document that we're looking at together tonight is unique. And, you know, one of the things we do, we've got a series that's coming up called Life and so on. One of the things we do in the second week of that is actually look at the evidences for this. If you've not been through that, then you've got to get along and see the overwhelming, extraordinary, it's one of the best kept secrets on the planet, the evidences for this book. But this book is unique. It's written by 40 authors, 40 different people over, I don't know, 1,500 years of writing history. I mean, much longer history than that, of course, but 1,540 different people on three different continents, all writing about the same thing the same way, without colluding, without getting together. And every time we can test what they say against history, because they report a lot of historical events, unlike other religious documents. Sacred texts for other religions do not engage with the events of history and talk about God being in them. It's just not part of other religions. This document does do that. And it does do that so that, I take it, I'm convinced, that God has made this book unique of all religious texts so that you might be convinced and sure that this is where God is revealing himself. It's an extraordinary thing. The evidence is overwhelming and it deals with a problem, the seriousness of which is beyond overstating. Now, to step into this epic, we're going to do it through a book that was written about AD 48, 49. About 16 years after Jesus died and was said to have been raised to life again. Now, it's written by a man called Paul. who was appointed by this very same Jesus to bring the news of what this whole book, this whole Bible was about to the world. And so we'll be stepping into the whole account of what the Bible is about through this small window of a particular passage we're looking at tonight, Galatians chapter 2. Now, if you've been with us the last few weeks, we're now sort of 3 weeks into this, going through this particular book, and we'll be going through it for the next weeks together, so we'll unpack more and more of it as we go along. But we're particularly up to chapter 2. If you've got your Bibles, flip open to chapter 2. I'm going to give a quick run through and give you some sense of what's happened. The section we're looking at is chapter 2, verse 11. It begins with an account of an event that happened in a city called Antioch, which is still there. You can go and visit it today. There was a conflict that happened between a man called Cephas or Peter, different language, the words, but Cephas and Paul, the author of this book. They had an altercation, a dispute, and it was very serious. It was quite a serious thing. And we're told by the author that it was a conflict that happened because of a very serious issue that was at stake. And then he goes on in verse 15 of chapter 2 to explain why he pursued this particular conflict. He explains the issues involved and why it mattered to deal with it. And when you understand it, it's huge. Now, he's going to use, as we look at this, we'll be looking particularly at verses 15 down to 16 and touching in some other areas. He uses some phrases that we're going to need to get a handle on to understand what he's saying. And I trust this is going to happen. A slide will come up. Yeah, chuck them all down. Can you do that? Without the definitions on them. Awesome. So there's a bunch of words that we're going to have to get a handle on to understand this passage. And I'm going to take you through them briefly. So just leave that up there for us. But the big idea behind this little passage, behind this conflict actually that happened at Antioch and his explanation is this. The big idea standing behind it all is how a human gets right with God. How does a human get right with God? How is it that a human can be accepted by the creator of the universe into relationship with himself, be connected to the divine creator? How is that possible? Well, just think with me for a moment. What sort of answers could you give to that? Don't say anything. Just think. What sort of answers could be given to how a human can be connected to the divine creator of the universe? How could that happen? Well, that in fact is the point of the very first word, justify. So long as we go along, I'm going to explain what these words mean. Justify. The word justify comes out of, and Paul uses it there, you'll see verse 16, know that a person is not justified. So the word's used there, it's used three times through these few verses. What does the word justified mean? Well, the word justified comes out of the legal kind of environment of the first century. So that if you went into the court and there was a judge kind of sitting over the case, as you came into the courtroom and you were being brought in by some, Roman soldiers or something like this who were, you'd been accused of a crime. Well, the evidence will be heard. Someone will say, yeah, he did this, is all the evidence. And no, he didn't do this. The judge will then make a determination. And if he decides that you are free to go, that you've got no case to answer for, he will justify you. He will declare you right. That's what it means to be justified. The opposite of being the opposite of being justified is to be condemned under a curse. Justified is you're justified. You're free to go. No case to answer for. Liberated. Now, how does a person get justified before God? How is it possible for God for a human to come before God and have God say, justified? No case to answer for. Accept it to me, no condemnation, free. How does a person get to receive that declaration from the creator of the universe? Well, you boil it down, there are two ways, and only two ways that you can be justified before God. There's the human way, and there's God's way. There's the human's way, and there's God's way, the human way. Let me explain that one. The human way is the obvious way, the natural way, the first thought way. If I just sort of immediately gave myself to thinking about how might a person be justified, declared right by God, this would be the way you'd come up with. It's just the most obvious, natural, first thought thing. It's the most natural thing. You get accepted by God because of something in you. This is the human way, being accepted by God. I get accepted by God because of something in me, by something I bring to God, by the fact that I'm basically a decent person. What's in me is basically good, although I mess up sometimes. I'm basically good, and so God will justify me, declare to be accepted, received by Him, welcomed by Him because of something in me, which is I'm pretty decent, or something I do. You know, the efforts I make, the desires to do efforts, the way I live, whatever, this human way of being justified by God has got to do with what's in me, what I bring to it, the way I deal with things. This is the most natural way of thinking about being justified. It's the most obvious way of thinking. It's the default way every human has. We drift to this way of thinking all the time. And it is so very, very wrong. It's so wrong that God did something to make it clear it was wrong. And here's where we enter into the epic nature of delving into history. I want to go massive with you and talk about the span of nations down through the centuries. God did something to make it clear that this way of thinking we'd be justified before God, having something in me, doing something, was wrong. And he did this. Back centuries ago, he chose a nation of people, the Jews. A Jew is a particular nation. Gentile means anyone who's not a Jew. So the Jew is God's chosen people. And if there's a definition there, we can throw that one up. Special people, and then you've got the rest. Now, God chose this particular group of people, the Jews. He gave them a religious system. Back with a man called Moses. You don't need to remember the name Moses particularly, but we're talking about 2,400 years ago, God did this. He gave them a religious system that fitted with the most natural way of thinking, that fitted with the most obvious way of thinking about being justified. He gave them a set of laws. Now, they were no ordinary set of laws because they were God's laws. They weren't just man-made up. They were God-given laws, the Ten Commandments. We know them as the Ten Commandments. They are so astonishingly good that we still have them as part of the fabric of many of our societies and our legal systems. They've just not been bettered. I mean, they came from God. They're an extraordinary set of laws. But he said this, and actually, if you come back to Exodus 19. Now, if you haven't got a Bible, you will have heard this read earlier, and you can just listen in again. If I will hope it's helpful to listen in again. Come with me to Exodus 19. We're talking now 2,500 years ago this happened and is recorded for us. Oh, gee, Jono, thank you so much. We've been 2,000 years since Jesus, haven't we? Yeah. See, if you go to a Bible college, you'll learn these things. And Jono's in almost his last year of Bible college, and he's picked that up. Yeah, 3,500 years ago. Just check. Is that right? Yes, thank you. I missed 1,000 years. It's 2,000 years back to Jesus. And then 1,400 years before Jesus. I should have just said that, but I was trying to be clever and go back from us. So 3,500, that's a lot, much longer ago, 3,400 years ago. Come with me to Exodus 19. This group of people have been rescued by God out of slavery in Egypt. So on the first day of the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on that very day, they came to the desert of Sinai, again a place you can go and visit. After they set out from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai. Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God And the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, this is what you were to say to the descendants of Jacob, which is another way of talking about the Jews. This is what you were to say to the descendants of Jacob and what you were to tell the people of Israel. Two ways of saying the same group of people. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. Now they responded, down in verse 8, and said, we will do everything the Lord has said. We will do everything the Lord has said. Now you look there at verse 5 again. If you obey me fully, not just piecemeal, not just a little bit here and there, but if you obey me fully, then you'll be mine. You will be justified. You'll be right with me. Now, to get right with God, according to Exodus 19, you've got to obey God fully. That's what the next phrase means, works of the law. Works of the law is the Ten Commandments and a bunch of other laws that we read about in the Old Testament. And God says, the works of the law, the works of the law just is what the law requires, the works that it requires. To obey it, they're the works. Now, the Ten Commandments, do not commit adultery. There's a work of the law. Don't commit adultery. Don't lie. Don't steal. Keep the seventh day and so on. You go through the law and you find out what it says, and the works of the law are the law's requirements. Now, what does else do? Well, there's a few other things it required, actually. It required, in the book of Leviticus, a bunch of food laws. You were not to eat animals that, had a cleft hoof and chewed the cud and didn't have scales, so you weren't able to eat lobster and prawns and you weren't able to eat pigs, and these are what the law required. And if you obeyed God fully and didn't do any of those things and circumcised your children, that was another thing the law required. If you did all of these rules, they were the works of the law, then you would be justified. You would be right. Now, it's a simple system. It's an obvious system. It makes perfect sense. If you're going to be accepted by the holy God of the universe, the perfect God, if you're going to be blessed by him and enjoy blessing with him forever, it makes perfect sense that you ought to be worthy of that blessing, that you ought to be good enough, that you have lived by the works of the Lord, doing what the law requires. Now, all of this was made even more crystal clear when you come to the book of Deuteronomy. Flip over a few books to the book of Deuteronomy, fifth book in, again written by Moses, that man that we mentioned met there in 19. Come and have a look at Deuteronomy 27, verse 26. I'll show you a couple of passages here. Verse 26. Cursed is anyone who does not uphold the words of this law by carrying them out. Cursed if you don't do the works of the law. If you don't do what the law requires, you are cursed. Look at chapter 28, verse 15. If you do not obey the Lord your God and do not carefully follow all his commands and decrees I'm giving you, then these curses will come upon you and overtake you. You won't be justified before me. You'll be cursed. You'll be condemned. Now, there it is. It's very simple. And it's identical to every religion on the planet except one. It's identical to every religion on the planet except one. Here's the list. Here's what the God, the divine being, requires. You keep them all. You do the works that they tell you to do, and you'll be declared right. You'll be accepted. You'll make it into. You'll be blessed. You'll receive blessings. If you don't do those things, or don't do all of those things, you'll be cursed. You won't be justified, you'll be condemned. Every religion, you boil it down, except one, says exactly that. So, Islam, You've got the five things required in Islam. You've got the particular prayer that you're to pray about Allah. You've got to pray five times a day facing. You've got to do giving. You've got to sacrifice your finances. You've got to go on a pilgrimage, and you've got to celebrate Ramadan. You do those five things, and you have fulfilled the law of God according to Islam, and you'll make it. You do the works. Buddhism, there's the five noble truths and the eightfold path. And when you boil all of that down, it basically says that if you live rightly according to these eightfold things, then you will escape the wheel of suffering and make it into the place of blessing. Again, what you do. If you do the things, if you fulfill the things, if you bring something of yourself that's worthy, you will make it. And we get this. It's natural. If there is a heaven, you know, the place of eternal blessing, if there is such a place, we all resent the idea that a child rapist might go there. I mean, it just offends against every principle of justice and fairness that someone unworthy would be in a place like that of blessing. The pedophile, the rapist, the mass murderer, the justice. You've got to fulfill and do something and bring something. Now, people who are basically decent, well, that makes sense that they might go there. But not people who are basically corrupt. Now, here's the deal. Why does God give this religious system back in these ancient times, 3,500 years ago? Why does he give this religious system? To show a profoundly important, almost impossible to get, truth. To show a profoundly important, but almost impossible to get truth. The truth that we can't keep the law. We can't keep doing the works of the law. Even with all the help in the universe, humans can't do them. Why can't we? Well, this is hard to hear, but it's undeniably true and easy to prove. Humans, every human, every single one of us here, every single one who's ever been born except one, is really, in profound ways, actually flawed. No, it's actually probably better to say, flawed is probably better than saying broken. I mean, I want to say broken, but we're flawed in a way that's deeper than just an accident's happened to us. There's something wrong with our character. Now, one way to think about the flaw that's in our character, it's not the only way, it's perhaps not even the best way, but one way of seeing the flaw, getting an insight into it being there, is to note that we are at heart, every one of us, selfish. Now, sure, there's moments you can put selfishness aside for a time, but it's never our settled position. It's kind of like, you can stretch the rubber band to be selfless, but you have to work harder and harder to keep it, then you just flop back into selfishness. Do you know, it's interesting in certain contexts, this works, in other contexts it doesn't, but it works in the context of parents. Typically, if I say to a group of parents, have you ever had to teach your child to be selfish? They all laugh because they're going, this group here, we never had to teach them to be selfish at all. But when I mention it amongst a group of people who've never had kids yet, they go, oh, my kids will be different. Well, wait and see. You have a child and, you know, I'm not going to be the dad that my dad was. I'm going to be this amazing dad. But you're not. You can't be. And this child is going to be... if I told you this story, I was at a pool once. I was kind of watching this event with a bloke who I'm good mates with and so on. He's not a churchgoer, not a Christian man. And he said to me, I said, how's your daughter going? He's got this little two-year-old. We had this little two-year-old a few years ago. And I said, how's your daughter going? He said, oh, man, I just don't know what's going on. He said, we have loved this child. We've given everything to this child. This child's been raised in this beautiful environment. That thing's selfish pig. And I laughed too. I went, "You're kidding." And he said, "Yeah, I don't know what's going on." And I said, "Oh man, I've got to have a big conversation with you about human nature. You do not give birth to perfect children that get corrupted. You give birth to children that are broken and flawed, that you work hard to actually minimise the expression of those flaws. That's parenting, you see. Foolishness, the Bible says, is caught up in the heart of a child, and the parent's role is to somehow massage that foolishness into some form of wisdom as the child grows. That's the task. It's not trying to not do damage to this perfect child, otherwise it'll turn out imperfect. No, no, no. Imperfect, trying to help it grow to express those imperfections less and less. There is the nature of humanity. Now, that is a hard thing to get and a hard thing to hear, although it's so obvious. It's fundamental to see this about ourselves. To see that we haven't got anything that we can bring to God. If justification requires me to bring something in myself to him that he goes, "Oh, awesome, that's really lovely, I'll have you." You're a fool. You just haven't got it. And God gives this whole religious system to show us that we cannot keep the law because of something broken in us. You see, God sees this about ourselves. He sees the basic orientation of our nature is towards selfishness. And yet, he sees too that although this basic orientation is of selfishness towards ourselves, we keep thinking he'll be okay with us. We keep thinking everything will be all right. And he goes, I'm deeply concerned that if you continue to live life thinking that you can be basically like that and it all be okay, you're going to die. And it's urgent that you get hold of this. So he gives the very best religious system humanity's ever known, the Ten Commandments, the Law of Moses, the Old Testament, and he says to that group of special people, do it. Let's see you do it. If you think the way to get justified is by what you do, go for it. And so he gives them this set of religious laws. And he says to them, if you obey me fully, I'll make it clear, if you obey me fully, then out of all the nations, you'll be my precious, blessed group. And if you don't obey me fully, you'll be under a curse. They're clear. Go for it. What happens? Well, before Moses is back down off the mountain to give them the laws, they've already failed. So God gives them another chance. And they fail. And they say, look, God, the reason we've failed is because the circumstances are really hard. I mean, it's how hard is it to do this? I mean, if you just made it easier, so God makes it easier. And they fail. Well, you didn't help us enough, God. Okay, I'll forgive you again and let's give you another shot at it and I'll make it easier and I'll help you, I'll send you people to help you. Fail. The history of this group of people is recorded for us. Let's see if I can do this for you. I won't do it exactly. There we go. There is the history of this group of people in the Old Testament. And it's a history of God's grace in bringing them to a place to help them, setting out what you've got to do, them saying, we'll do it, failing. God saying, all right, let's try again. I'll do it this way. Here's what you've got to do, and if you do it, you'll be in. Fail. All right, let's try again. It's the whole thing is fail, 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 fail. You don't need to read it anymore. It's just what it says. Now, this is huge. Get this. God gave that whole history to teach us a number of points, but one of the big ones was that humanity might learn something, that we are so flawed, we cannot get justified before God by anything in us, by any works we might do, by any goodness we might bring. Now come back with me to Galatians, that book that we started with. My hope is that step by step, you'll see some of the background and now make sense of what's going on here. Can you come and have a look at verse 15 of chapter 2? We who are Jews by birth and not sinful, foolish Gentiles, we who are Jews by birth know that a person is not justified by the works of the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ. So we too have put our faith in Christ Jesus that we might be justified by faith in Christ and not by works of the law. Because by works of the law, no one will be justified. You see, he says it three times. He says it three times. We know that people are not justified by works of the law. They don't get right with God by what they do, by anything in them. We know that. But at least we who have put our faith in Christ as Jews know that. That's the we. So we have put our faith because we know it's not by works of the law that you're justified. Because the works of the law, no one will be justified. Do you see how he's hammering away on it? Because it's such a natural way to think. It's such an obvious way to think. It's such a drift into the tendency of the way we think that if I just be better, if I just pretend I'm good enough. And he bangs away and bangs away. Now, the problem is humans can be a very defensive group. Naive, blind. We keep denying it's us. You know, that was them. It's because of the way they were. They weren't enlightened like we are. So we make up another religion, which is all about what we ought to do and how we really can do it, and fail to notice that we never actually do whatever we say we ought to do anyway. I was talking with this person once. It was a lady this time, so man, lady, be fair. I was talking to this lady And I had this afternoon tea. I'd popped around to see this family and they had some friends around for afternoon tea and we were chatting together and so on. And it turns out they work out who I am. I'm the minister of a church and so on. And so they start talking about ministry things. And we get into this conversation about getting to God and being connected with God. And they say, yeah, look, I think we'll be okay. We'll be all right with God. And I say, you know, why is that? Well, you know, we believe if you just keep doing the right thing, you'll be okay. And I go, all right. So you believe that if you just keep doing the right thing, you'll be okay. Yeah. Do you always just keep doing the right thing? Well, no. No one's perfect. You know, we don't always. But you just said, as long as we keep doing the right thing, we'll be okay. Well, what I mean is, as long as you many times do the right thing, you'll be okay. I say, okay, so many times? Do you do the right thing? Well, not many times. Do you do the right thing sometimes? Yeah, sometimes. Is that what you think? Well, no, I think God accepts us if we just try to do the right thing. Okay, all right. Let's use that definition. Do you try to do the right thing all the time? No, I don't try to. But I think God really just accepts us if we want to try to do the right thing all the time. And so slowly the standard just drifts down and down and down. And eventually you end up this place where as long as one time in your life you'd wanted to try to do the right thing, you'll be okay. And you kind of say back, but when you that one time wanted to try to do the right thing, did you really want to? Or was it not really wanting to? I can't remember now. Do you see, the whole thing just boils down into this morass of foolishness. It's so hard to get this lesson. We are deeply flawed as humans. And we keep thinking, do you know, I'll give you another quick story. During the Second World War, who knows about the Second World War, Jews and Germans and so on and so forth? Hands up. Okay, good. I just remember one occasion I was doing this Christian explanation to a group of 20 people. They'd never heard of Hitler. And so I was kind of, my whole illustration was blown. But so just remember, you know, during the Second World War, the Germans and the concentration camps, the Jews were being carted off to the concentration camps and fed through the gas chambers. Yes? 6 million of them were slaughtered during the Second World War. Horrendous. Now, what role did the German people have in that? Well, you want to go, They were just made to by the authorities. The evil authorities, decent men and women, were made to out of fear? No. The research indicates that they were active participants knowing it was happening. Now, is that just because Germans are really evil people? No. You are exactly as evil as them. And me too. That's the nature. You put any of us in the right context over a length of time, which is what happened in the German situation, you put any of us in the right context for a certain length of time, put the situation in a certain way, and this flaw that's within us will show itself in the most horrendous acts. We just happen to be in a society that keeps the lid on it. But you put us, any of us, in another place, we are deeply flawed. Now, why was God so determined to get this message across? Because he wants to have us right with himself. Because there is another way. But this other way, you'll only go if you truly get the problem with the natural way, the human way. This other way, it's got to do with the crucifixion of Jesus. You come down there to verse 19, 20 and so on. Let's pick up a couple of things there. In verse 20, the crucifixion of Jesus is mentioned. I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. This is a reference to an historical event that we have recorded for us outside the Bible, of the death of Jesus nailed to a cross under the Roman law, where he was judged to be seeking to overthrow the authorities at the time, and the religious leaders condemned him and brought political pressure to bear, and so he was crucified. Now, the nature of that crucifixion, though, that death of Jesus, was something unlike any other death. Because you have a look there in verse, second half of 20. The life I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God. And here's the words I want you to notice. Who loved me and gave himself for me. Who loved me and gave himself for me. So far it's been negative, but here's the positive. The God who is, the real God, loves. And he loves the world that's flawed like it is. He loves it. It's astonishing. But he does. He's holy, righteous, and just. And he loves. And he doesn't want humans to die, to be shut off from him forever. So he gives this law system to show the problem. That if you think it'll all just be okay by how you are and who you are, you're a fool. He gives it to show us this truth about ourselves. And then gives the solution. The solution that deals with the problem, the only solution that can deal with the problem. God gave his son, now look at verse 20, the end of verse 20, those last two words, for me. They're the key words. For me. For us. Now, stick your finger there. I want to chase through this language of for me. And I want to show you the words of Jesus. Come with me to Mark chapter 10. This idea of for me is riddled throughout the New Testament. Jesus himself speaks of it in chapter 10 of Mark, verse 45. He says, even the Son of Man, which is a way of talking about himself, did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life, to give his life as a ransom for many. For many. Now that Greek word there is the word anti. It's in the place of, it's the substitute. And of course, looking at the language that's used there, it has to be the language of substitute, because what is a ransom? He's given his life as a ransom for many. How does a ransom work? Well, a ransom assumes that people are held captive to something. They've been hostage, held hostage, ransomed, captive by a power that's over them that they can't get out of. They've got no ability to escape from. Someone steps in and offers his own life in their place. Now, it's the life of someone precious. So some power has taken captive 30 children in a school. And they say, we'll let the 30 kids go if the Prime Minister takes their place. Now, it won't just work. If Jono walks up and says, can you have me? I'll say, we'll give you one child, one of the unhealthy sick children. We'll let one of those go free if we take Jono. But you were speaking earlier. but if someone of great value and worth comes, the Prime Minister say, well, depending on how your politics goes, but someone of great worth comes and they say, the Queen comes and we say, you can have all 30 kids, go for it. Because the replacement value. See, what Jesus says is, I've come to give my life as a ransom for many. To take their place under captivity that they might go, please. That's what the word for, in the place of, as the substitute for. Now come back to Galatians. Galatians chapter 2. Second half of verse 20. Who loved me and gave himself for me as a ransom for me. Paul reflects on this exact same thought again in chapter 3, verse 10. All who rely on works of the law are under a curse. All who rely on works of the law are actually under a curse. Why? Because of the very verse that we read earlier from Deuteronomy chapter 27. Cursed is everyone who does not continue to do everything written in the book of the law. Clearly, no one who relies on the law is justified before God because the righteous will live by faith. The law is not by. We'll come to this in future weeks, but look at verse 13. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. See those words again. For us, in our place. Now you know it's in our place because of the next sentence. Cursed is everyone who's hung on a tree. When he died on the cross, he didn't die on the cross for his own sin. He died on the cross for the curse of every other person who failed to do the works of the law. He himself did the works of the law. He kept the works of the law. He did all that the law required. He was the only human who ever did. And so he deserved to be justified before God. But no other human has. So why does Jesus die? Well, he dies under the curse that we deserve. He dies in our place as the ransom to let us go free. He is our substitute. And in this context, chapter 3, verse 13, the law, that wonderful law of God, is now described as a power that's holding us ransom, holding us hostage. Its condemnation is over us. We are under its curse. Now, you might be sitting there going, I'm not that. You might be thinking, I don't pay any attention to the law. I don't care about the law. I'm not under its curse at all. No, you misunderstand. You may not think you're under the law and under its curse because you're not keeping it. You don't even care to keep it. You don't care whether you keep it or not. How can I be under its curse? Because whether you realise it or not, we are all under the law. This is a crass illustration and it doesn't work perfectly, but just imagine you live in Australia, you're working in a job and you say to yourself, I'm not under the tax law. You know, I don't even care about it. I don't pay tax. I don't feel the burden of tax. I don't feel the curse of tax. I just don't even pay it. One day you will. One day you will. Because you live in a land where you are under it, even though you deny its power over you. It does have a power over you and will catch up with you. Now, here's the deal. We all one day will stand before God. And his law, his perfect standard that expects us to keep everything in it, will be there. And you can live all your days here disregarding, disregarding, disregarding. But it still sits there, waiting for the day when you stand before God and the books are opened, all is accounted for, and your failure, my failure, to do everything written in the book of law is evident. And God says, cursed, cursed. At some point, the law will catch up. Now, I don't know what your reaction is to hearing that news. Perhaps you think to yourself, that's not how I like to think about God. That's kind of irrelevant, isn't it? It's kind of irrelevant how I like to think about God. What's relevant is what God's actually like. That's relevant. And if he is different to how you'd like to think of him, you need to know that. Is this true? Is God like this? Book after book after book of the Bible is written by God saying, I'm like this, I'm like this, I'm like this. Do not be ignorant. I'm sending out messengers so that you might know that this is the truth and I'm like this. You are under the law. You are required to do everything written in if you're to be justified by me. You haven't. You're under a curse and it will catch up with you. Now, Jesus loved me because the Father, God, sent him out of his love. Jesus loved me and gave himself for me to become a curse for us. He enters our world, he lives under a law, under its demands, he lives the law's way, he keeps everything written in the book of the law, he does the works the law requires, and then suffers the law's curse, the condemnation for those that fail to live it. Now, what's going on? That suffering wasn't his own, it was ours. And God transferred to him our curse. So that, now this is unique, this is unique, this is unique of all the religions of the world, which alerts you to something. That we're not now just dealing with a human manufactured idea. That's what all the other religions are. They're all the same. They all say the same thing. But this one stands on its own because it's come from God. And this one says, we can be united to Jesus, linked to Jesus, be in Jesus, if we would but throw ourselves upon his mercy, which is to put our faith. That's what faith is. It's to trust Jesus. And if we do that, says the Bible, then his righteous works of the law count as ours. And the curse that he suffered, which we deserve, is no longer ours. It's on him. So that if I'm in him, it's as if the curse has fallen on me, although it hasn't. It's fallen on my substitute. Now, we're going to deal with this more in weeks to come. The concept is extraordinary. I've racked up a debt, but it's been paid by another. The concept's not hard to get. I've built up this tax debt, ignorantly living as if I was under no obligation, and then find out tragically I am, someone steps in and says, I'll pay it for you. Jesus. Get the feel, though, of this. We've heard a lot about this prison system in Indonesia. Chappelle Corby. Hellhole. Dreadful. Imagine you are the foolish one who travels to Indonesia taking drugs with you, thinking everyone else gets caught, I won't. I'm going to make a killing. And they catch you. They put you in prison and they put you there for 30 years. Your life is now gone. But imagine this. Imagine someone steps in and says, I will take your place in prison. I'll suffer the law's condemnations that you deserve. I'll take it in your place, so that you can go out and be free. You can have the life that I had, and I'll take your place in that. Now, he does it not in some secret way, not in some underhanded way. He does it out in the open, where everyone agrees that this is acceptable, so that when you are freed out by his substitution, it's not as if the police can turn up one night and say, oh, we've caught you. You go, no, 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 I've paid. I've paid my debt in full in my substitute. I'm free. I'm free from the law. The law of Indonesia has nothing to do against me. It's got nothing to say against me. I can live as I please. I don't have to be bound by the law of Indonesia anymore. It's exactly what Paul is saying. Look at verse 19. For through the law I died to the law so that I might live for God. One suffered under the law in my place so that I'm now out from under that law, the law of works, the law of doing this to deserve it, the works of being worthy, I'm out. And I'm free. You will never hear that anywhere in any other religion. All religions are the same? No, they're not. There are two kinds of religions. Every religion, bar one, says that if you do the works that the law requires enough, you'll be justified. And you can live that way if you want. But know for a certainty you won't ever be able to do the works of the law. A whole nation was taken through it to show you that you won't. But there is one that says, another has done it for us, we're free. We're free. We're justified by faith, by trusting Jesus and his merits and what he's done so that I can be accepted by God and connected back to God, not because I'm better than anyone else, but because he was better than everyone else, because he suffered my curse in my place. This kind of man-made human religion, this works of the law religion, it always leads to oppression and guilt and fear. You never know if you've done enough. You're always racking whether you... And it always destroys. Whatever religion you choose, it will always destroy. That's the kind man makes up all the time. The kind of religion man would never make up is one that says, man can't contribute. We aren't good enough. But God has done everything himself for us. Trust him and not yourself. Turn to him and find by grace, which is the kindness you don't deserve, that we can now be justified. Now, one last thought, and then I'll see if there's any questions. The last paragraph there, which we'll come back to in weeks ahead, just adds this incredible truth that when you're justified by the merits of another, it changes your whole life. It changes you from the inside out. Law oppresses and keeps trying to change you from the outside and make you to be someone that you just inside aren't. But when you come to Jesus, he by his Spirit takes up residence within you, transforms your whole life from the inside, and begins to grow in you something that you would never have imagined possible. Let me finish then, friends. Two religions, two places to be. Only two. Only two. You are either under law. Now, I know you may not feel like you are, but you are under law in that if there is a God, and I'm convinced there is one, he will only receive you if either you have performed or you have fled to one who has. If there is a God, he will only receive you if you have performed and been good enough, been decent enough, tried as much as you... If you've done all of that, you'll be accepted. Or if you've fled to the one who has done it. God so loved you that he's gone to lengths to show that no one can gain justification by their efforts. It's just not possible. God has given the whole Old Testament Jewish system religion to help us see that truth. It's so important to grasp. He loves us so much. He's given us that and given himself for us in our place as a substitute to pay the curse that we ought to pay, to live the life we ought to live, flee to him and find freedom. Find freedom from guilt and oppression and destruction and despair and depression. And it's just, it's beautiful.